Since our last program on politics, the federal government has partially shut down. In our region, Democrats have run ads blaming the shutdown on Republican Congressman Rodney Davis. Meanwhile, Davis has been seated on a conference committee working on a new farm bill. In Springfield, lawmakers are still trying to agree on pension reform, but at least they're getting paid now that the courts have overturned the governor's veto of their salaries. I'm Jim Meadows. Today on Focus, we'll talk politics with Illinois Public Radio's Amanda Vinicky and Tom Kasich of the News Gazette. And we'll talk with the new GOP leader in the Illinois House, Jim Durkin, about his plans for the fall veto session and next year's election. Focus continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. And we're making a program on politics here today, another hour trying to figure things out with a nod towards Springfield and Washington. Along with me to answer your questions and my questions are Tom Kasich, reporter at the News Gazette. Good morning, Tom. Welcome back. Good
morning, Jim. Nice to be here.
And fresh from her brand new offices in the State House, Amanda Vinicky, the State House Bureau Chief at Illinois Public Radio. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Okay, how are the new quarters?
They are still a work in progress, but I don't know. Do I sound okay? That's the big test for radio, right?
You sound good? Fine.
good. Come on by and visit.
Okay. Well, later in the hour, we'll be talking with State Representative Jim Durkin. He's the new Republican leader in the Illinois House. If you have questions for Leader Durkin and his plans for the GOP in the House, you can email them now at will-talk@illinois.edu. Our toll-free phone number, both for that segment and our talk right now with Tom and Amanda, is 1-800-222-9566. That's 1-800-222-WILL. And, well, there was a point yesterday, Tom and Amanda, that I thought we'd be talking about a settlement or a path to a settlement in the fight in Congress that caused a partial shutdown of the federal government. I thought that would have been pretty much settled by sometime yesterday, but it was not. And now people are talking like, well, this default thing could get even closer. Amanda, does the federal shutdown affect state government in meaningful ways, or will it if this continues?
Yes, I think that there are definitely ways that it has an impact. And so, yes, it is not that state government is unable to function in any way, shape, or form. However, Illinois depends in a lot of cases on receiving money from the federal government. You've seen Illinois had to kind of just move money around, for example, to enable the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or like traditionally known as food stamps, to be able to continue. They moved money around to do it, but that can't keep up forever. We'll also see, of course, an impact when it comes to health care. Illinois is part of the Affordable Care Act, signed on to an expansion of Medicaid. Well, that relies on getting an 100% federal match, and Illinois has said we won't continue to give those new individuals that are newly eligible for Medicaid that health care assistance unless the federal government pays. Well, if the federal government isn't paying, right there you could see an impact. And then, of course, there are also a whole lot of federal workers throughout the state, and in many ways that has a, you know, a connection and a nexus to state government. And I think also Illinois is very fragile economically. It has been slower than many other states to recover. And so the worst that you see the economic spinoff of this hold in Congress, that will continue to hurt Illinois as it seeks to increase the employment rate.
I want to step in here and say I apologize. I gave the phone number incorrectly just a few minutes ago. It is actually 1-800-222-9455. That's 9455. 1-800-222-WILL for your questions for Tom and Amanda and for Illinois House Minority Leader Jim Durkin later in the program. Tom, are there little rustlings and worries that you're seeing on as you go about covering your stories for the News Gazette?
I think, what I've seen is that Illinois is actually better off than a lot of states, less dependent on federal funding now than it was in the past. was at a county board meeting last night. They said the Head Start program in Champaign County is unaffected by this. There was some concern at the nursing home that their cash flow would be affected by it with Medicaid and Medicare reimbursements.
This is the Champaign County Nursing Home where they voted on a loan last night for the county board.
Correct. They last night agreed to attempt a $900,000 loan to help out with their cash flow, which is partially kind of a hedge in case this federal impasse continues. But I think that for the most part, Champaign County's been pretty well unaffected by this problem, unlike some other states, especially with big defense contractors and installations.
Okay. Tom, I know Congressman Rodney Davis has faced ads from groups tied to the Democrats trying to hit him on the shutdown. As a matter of fact, I'm looking at an email that came into the show today. I'm trying to figure out. Yes, it's from the House Majority PAC, and they are the liberal group that has been running these TV ads comparing Congressman Davis to a crying baby in terms of the shutdown. And as the headline for the email says, the economic cost of Representative Rodney Davis's government shutdown, $20 billion and counting. I'm just wondering, is this working? Is this having any impact on Mr. Davis?
You know, the polls show nationally that it's going to affect everybody, that not every single person polled, but that the polls show that every congressman is at risk. Everybody's angry with Congress, and they're inclined to vote against their congressman. But you know, we're a year away from the general election, and even in Illinois, we're 5 months away from the primary. So this stuff could all blow over, or it could, you know, if this thing drags out or comes up again in January or February, like they're talking, this can happen all over again. This debt ceiling could be deferred. I mean, they could pass a temporary fix today or tomorrow, but then have to do it again during the dead of winter. So that'd be right before the primary again.
Now, Rodney Davis is running in the 13th district where there's definite Democratic opposition, apparently with some money potentially behind it. John Shimkus is running in the 15th district where if the Democrats are fortunate, they will have a real opponent against him, but not much interest in really spending money on the race.
It is such an overwhelmingly Republican district, in part because Shimkus helped draw it 2 years ago, that it's hard for a Dem to even run there. And, you know, we have a loyal Democrat from Champaign County who's taken up the mantle of trying to run against Shimkus, but it's a very, very large, very rural district. The largest city in that district is Danville, and you know, it's tough for somebody who's new and unknown to break through in a district like that.
And that candidate is Eric Thorsland, who is the chairman of the Champaign County Zoning Board of Appeals. I think that's the highest political office he's held to date.
Correct.
And the other candidate is Angela Michaels, who was on the ballot in the last election.
Correct.
She is essentially running to promote
pro-life
and anti-abortion arguments.
Correct. And she's from Shimkus's area. She's from one corner of the district. Eric Thorsland's from another corner of the district, and it's. We'll see what happens. But Shimkus is well known. He's got a lot of money, and neither Thorsland or Michael have much money or much name recognition.
Amanda, you're in Springfield, so you're in the 13th congressional district, and with, I guess, a total of five congressional candidates that I can count so far. Have they been coming around to do some politicking in Springfield?
We've seen a little bit of it, mostly the Davis and Callis candidates are the ones who we've seen. As you said, there's a whole lot of money going into that race. And so trying to make hay really at this juncture, at least for the Democratic challenger, of trying to get a kind of push out of the government shutdown. And as you talked about, that the baby ad and taking it a step beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Callis, that's, I think, Ann Callis, the former judge.
Pardon me, yes.
Who is the Democrat.
Madison County former chief judge, yes.
When she comes around, does she talk about things like the government shutdown and trying to blame it on the Republicans, or is she just working up her own credentials here.
No, it's really only since the government shut down that we have seen her appear. That was the premise of multiple press conferences that she has had, really trying to capitalize on it from a political perspective in maybe that's not the appropriate terminology that she would agree with, and saying that she doesn't want to capitalize it on it, but that this is exactly why she should be voted in, because she would not stand for this sort of government dysfunction. Of course, that's very easy to say when you're on the outside and you're not being asked to take votes, but it does get to the question of blame. As Tom indicated, this, by the time the election actually rolls around, this may well be far in the rearview mirror and won't stick in government's mind, in voters' minds. That said, I think the state of how really bad it's gotten and how disgusted voters are with what has gone on with the shutdown does make any sort of incumbent vulnerable, especially somebody like Rodney Davis, who really had kind of a harder time getting to office, who is a freshman, unlike, as we were talking about, John Shimkus, who is, you know, so well known in the district. Davis really isn't as much. And so that's where I think you're going to see a whole lot of money poured in from both parties. And yes, we are seeing that begin to happen with Ann Callis.
Tom, you've reported in the News Gazette on Congressman Davis being named to a House Senate Conference Committee that's working on a new farm bill. And I believe Davis voted for a previous attempt at a farm bill, which was notable for not including what we used to call food stamps.
Correct.
At all, to be handled
Correct.
Separately. I take it that's not going anywhere in the Senate, so they're trying again.
They have a conference committee. They're working with the senators. There's a lot of hope that they can actually write a new farm bill, which actually ran out September 30th. But, Davis and, from what I understand, the House Republicans want to continue to separate the farm bill from the food stamp bill, have a separate piece of legislation. And the Democrats are not going to go along with that, neither the House Democrats nor the Senate Democrats. So, they talk a lot about compromise and getting together and how a conference committee will iron all this out. But if the Republicans insist on having a separate piece of legislation, even the American Farm Bureau Federation is opposed to that. That will be a real stumbling block to a compromise.
Now, considering the appointment, is there any chance that Davis's appointment to this committee, he's the only freshman House member on the committee, was made with the election in mind to increase his visibility for rural voters, people who care about the farm bill, in the upcoming election, knowing that his district may not be a guaranteed shoo-in for Republicans?
You are absolutely right in mentioning that. I think, you know, they're going to do, the House Republican leadership is going to do all it can to help Rodney Davis win this race again. They're helping financially, clearly helping financially. But, they're going to give him plum appointments. He's a freshman, so that, generally freshmen don't get appointed to such major committees, but they want him to get visibility, and, this will be more free publicity for him.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking about politics with Tom Kasich of the News Gazette, Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Radio, and we welcome your questions and comments at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, and you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Amanda, the fall veto session starts in Springfield next week. And I guess a few days after that, the conference committee working on pension reform will mark its 4-month anniversary. I don't know how long they expected the committee to last, but you've been reporting on them and how they're starting to, I guess they're starting to hear more from Governor Quinn on working out pension reform than they did several weeks ago. But do the members tell you whether or not they're making progress towards a plan?
Yes. So as you said, they're about at the 3.5-month mark now. And it's funny because Governor Pat Quinn, I was listening back to the press conference when this was going to be the path, kind of the new attempt, the new group of legislators to try and reach a solution. He was giving them 3 weeks. And of course, it was at that point that he then vetoed their salaries and out of the budget. And even at that point, and kind of this gets to, I think, the very tenuous relationship that the governor has with legislators, because it was abundantly clear that 3 weeks wasn't going to be long enough for it. They hadn't even really been, you know, appointed right at that point. It was just a nebulous committee. And so that's where you hear a lot of the accusations that governor's legislative salary veto was pure politics, because there was no way they could have gotten any sort of numbers or figures scored at that point. There was no way to get a bill to his desk in that hurry. Something that I think could be very well undercut as you now look to see, for example, President John Cullerton saying maybe we don't need a bill that comes out of the conference committee. Maybe we can put it on another one. So the General Assembly can, you have seen, push something through very quickly. If they have a will, they will make a way. But at this point, we are still hearing that the pension committee is negotiating, that they're at a standstill. You've basically had Republicans saying that they don't think it goes far enough, and at least one Democrat saying that she thinks it goes a little too far in terms of hurting workers and retirees whose benefits would be reduced in any sort of plan. Of course, that's how you would achieve savings. Before we kind of carry on, I would like to say, because as you had mentioned, Governor Pat Quinn interacting more, but it doesn't take much for him to do more because he really wasn't doing anything for the first 3 months of the committee, other than making a lot of public statements and press releases. I spoke with all 10 members of the conference committee, and other than the chairman, Kwame Raoul, who cited conversations with the governor's budget director here and there, all of the legislators said that the only conversation that they had with Pat Quinn were things that, like, bill signing or ceremonial or political events where they shook his hand and said hi. Nothing in terms of pension discussions. So the month of October, you have seen the governor hold a grand total of, I believe, 4 meetings as of this taping with the 10 members of the Legislative Conference Committee. Not to say that those produced, from what I have heard, any sort of major action or agreement, but at the very least, a reach out.
Is the governor becoming more active, perhaps as election time nears? He was in Champaign a couple of days ago. And I know our reporter, Sean Powers, noted with some surprise that he actually spent a full 20 minutes answering questions of reporters, which is he doesn't always do that.
You know, I think actually I would say that that is not an area where the governor falls short. He generally, not to say that he never answers questions, but if he's at a public appearance, he generally is very good about answering questions and taking time with reporters. Maybe depending on your definition of answer, you often hear from Governor Quinn, he is high on platitudes and not necessarily pointed when he answers the questions, doesn't necessarily give any sort of, you know, real news or real answer. He's going to say what he's going to say no matter what, but he will definitely take the time to speak with reporters and say it. Where we may not get enough interaction is that the governor most definitely spends a majority of his time in the city of Chicago and less downstate. You have seen him make appearances in Champaign, as you indicated. He was also recently in Harrisburg and far downstate Illinois. And yes, I think that you're going to see bits and pieces of that as the election draws near. But of course, the election, I think, in his eyes, will very much be won in Chicago. That's where he was able to win the last time around, even though he didn't win basically any other county in the state of Illinois. That's an exaggeration, but not by much. He won Chicago. So you're going to see him want to focus on TV appearances there. And that gets to this whole pension discussion and kind of some of the accusations that you've heard from members of the conference committee is that the governor is more active when it comes to holding press releases, ribbons cuttings, and getting free press. I'll note that, for example, whereas all of the other candidates for governor have long had spokespeople that we go through, you know, he doesn't even have a campaign spokesperson at this point in time. He really doesn't need one. He's the incumbent. He's running the show there. So doing more politicking and less governing is the accusation that you get from critics.
Let me go ahead and take a call that takes us back, I believe, to the congressional races. This is Line 1, Deborah from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Thank you. Full disclosure, I am part of George Gollin's campaign. I will say that I joined the campaign because I believe he is the right person for this time. He knows how to negotiate without flamethrowing and without relying on talking points. The point I wanted to make very quickly was that Ms. Vinicky mentioned that only mentioned Ann Callis as campaigning in the Springfield area, whereas George Gallin is in the Springfield area several times a month, and he has made a point of going throughout the district on a rather rigorous schedule. So he is campaigning throughout the district. He is able to negotiate while articulating and maintaining progressive principles, which I think this district wants and needs.
Okay. Well, Deborah, thank you very much. And maybe we should just lay all the names of the Democratic candidates out there. That's George Gallin, Ann Callis, the former judge, and also the third candidate?
David Green.
Who is
of Champaign, and George Gallin is also of Champaign.
Okay. And
you know, and I'll add here, I'm sorry for leaving that out. That said, I know, surprisingly, actually, given all of the money and the research that goes into these campaigns, I, as a reporter in Springfield, had to proactively sign up for each of the campaign's newsletters and haven't received, I think today I actually got my first Gallin press release in terms of money raised for the election. But any sort of events that he's had here in Springfield, I don't believe I have received an invitation to as a member of the press or any sort of media events. So I could be wrong, get lots of emails, but I don't think so. And like I said, it's actually been surprising to me that all of the campaigns missed out.
Well, and of course, there's also one other candidate, and that's a Republican challenger to Congressman Davis, Urbana attorney. And as just about every news media mention of her will note, former Miss America Erica Harold. And has she been coming around to Champaign, to the Springfield?
You know, the last time that I saw her was at the state fair when she was in attendance for the Republican Day at those kind of partisan events. But that's the last that I believe I got a visit from her, that we saw, heard from her in Springfield.
Okay. And, of course, we should note this is early. No one's even turned in their petitions yet. They
exactly.
can't turn them in yet until the State Board of Elections starts taking them. So come by around January or February, and things should be a lot more active. Amanda, I want to ask you, looking ahead to the fall veto session, what do you expect to be taken up during this session?
The first week looks like it's going to be very tame, and I'm even hearing indications that a day may be canceled that first week of veto session. Legislators are procrastinators extraordinaire, and so there's a week break, and then they'll be back, and so that really will be the more active time. You're hearing from advocates of same-sex marriage that they want a vote after they did not get one when the regular veto session ended. That was a very emotional, a lot of tears on the floor of the Illinois House when no vote was taken. And so there's still a lot of pressure for that to occur. But whether that will mount to anything, we don't know. There are rallies scheduled for kind of both sides of that, the advocates of gay marriage and those who are part of the defense of marriage that plan big events here in Springfield. There may be some legislation when it comes to guns. Illinois, of course, readying to implement its new concealed carry law. So we could see maybe some tweaks to that. There's also a pitch to institute mandatory minimum prison sentences for those who have unlawful use of a weapon. Those are the big things. And then, of course, everybody wants to know pensions. I'm just not sure we're going to see anything with that. We'll hear a lot about it at the very least, but way too early, and I don't think even the powers that be really know what is going to happen at this juncture when it comes to that.
Let me go ahead and take another caller on line 4, Ray in Effingham. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Well, my point is, you know, there's a lot of complaints about voter turnout being low so often, but when they redraw the districts, so there's no hope of a true democracy where you can vote on either side. I don't like it when either side does it. So is there anything the average person can do to change that?
You know, there's actually a redistricting movement that there is a campaign that is looking to put that on the ballot. So, yes, there is an attempt. Whether that will succeed, previous discussions have not done that, and there have been previous attempts to get that passed on the ballot. We're going to see kind of a crowded ballot this time around when it comes to such initiatives, because one of the Republican candidates for governor is trying to institute term limits, and there's also some potential talk of trying to institute a progressive tax, and that would need to go, it require a change to the Constitution. So if voters agree to change the redistricting process, yes, but that is something that is in really neither party's best interest. And so that's, I think, why you've seen those ballot initiatives have some major hurdles, because they're also have some kind of quiet yet resilient resistance.
The group that's pushing that redistricting reform is called Yes for Independent Maps. And they're not really well organized downstate yet. I wrote a column about them a couple weeks ago. And they need 300,000 signatures by early May, which is a big hurdle. And it's going to be hard to do that during the winter, but they say they're going to really push it.
Their website is independentmaps.org. I believe one of the Republican gubernatorial candidates has already endorsed them.
Rutherford.
Yes, Dan Rutherford.
Rutherford.
Yeah.
And I was also seeing some news accounts as I Google around here saying that perhaps a Fairer Maps would help Republicans more than Democrats overall in Illinois. Well,
I think just because Democrats are in charge.
Yeah, exactly.
And so so it's very that's why it would help. You basically saw the most recent maps. Again, Democrats would, of course, dispute this and say, no, what are you talking about? We're fair. And it has passed before challenges to the court that have been attempted by Republicans. But because you have a Democratic controlled House and Senate in Illinois, as well as a Democratic governor, Democrats were able to draw the maps without really any input from Republicans.
There are other states where they do attempt to have more nonpartisan map systems. And I think we should note, Tom, that Champaign County in the last redistricting process instituted a commission that was meant to depoliticize the drawing of the county board district maps. Do you, just using that as an example, do you think that commission worked its first time out?
The Democrats or the Republicans would say no. The Democrats would say yes. The map submitted came from a group affiliated with Democrats. So, the Democrats could not directly say that they directly drew the map, but I think Republicans were disappointed with that process.
Ray, I wanted to thank you very much for your call. We'll see what happens with that idea as the election season progresses. You know, going back to the pension reform issue, one thing we haven't been talking about, the legislature could do something. They could do a lot of different things about pension reform, and it just sounds like any one of them could potentially be rejected by the Illinois Supreme Court. And any pension reform proposal is going to be appealed to court. How much do we have any idea of how much room the lawmakers have to work with in terms of pension reform short of amending the state constitution?
Which we haven't seen any attempts to do. Just to be clear there, you're right, the Constitution could be changed, but nobody's looking to do that at this point, at least nobody, you know, credible or putting a lot of effort or money into that. So, yes, you hear legislators and the governor when they say pension reform, they also say constitutional. But as you indicated, really there's no way to tell what the court will consider constitutional. And so there is some latitude. You heard, for example, President John Cullerton being very insistent on a legal theory that he says basically could make it constitutional if, in exchange for giving something up in their pensions, the retirees and state workers get an advantage. So that's where you look maybe at the proposal that the conference committee has been fixated on would say that employees could give less, put less of their paychecks into their retirement benefits in exchange for, you know, getting a lesser benefit. And so that would maybe meet constitutional muster. But it's really impossible to tell. I mean, nobody knows the thinking of the Illinois State Supreme Court justices, and they're not able to. I mean, that would be very wrong for any sort of legislator to try and persuade or give arguments to the Supreme Court justices. I will add that, of course, there are people would very much stand up for the ability of the court to act without an eye toward politics. And yet, of course, like everything else, this is the state of Illinois. It is a political court. You have the justices that are one very well-financed campaigns that come from very steady backers. So you can also look to the court and perhaps see an indication, maybe not in their legal theory, and what they will cite, what previous court cases they will bring into it and precedents. But there are a lot of political connections, of course, with members of that court, who, I will add, also draw state pensions.
We're talking about politics here on Focus on WYLL with Amanda Vinicky, the State House Bureau Chief of Illinois Public Radio, and Tom Kasich, reporter for the News Gazette in Champaign-Urbana. Later this late in the hour, we're still trying to make telephone contact with the new Illinois House Minority Leader, Jim Durkin. And he has, I think, a lot of big challenges ahead of him because the Democrats enjoy supermajorities in both chambers, and people seem to think that the House Speaker Michael Madigan is some sort of wizard who is nearly all powerful. What Amanda? What do you think that? How can Republicans make gains? Are they in the Illinois legislature? What avenues do they have to try?
You know, I think that it is, as you indicated, going to be very difficult for Republicans. Jim Durkin is coming in as he's losing. I could be wrong in the number here, but I believe a dozen members of the House Republican caucus. And as we've kind of nipped around the edges, it is incumbents who generally have an easier time winning reelection. And so you're going to see that already be difficult. They're having to recruit candidates, spend more money on name recognition, and it's in a lot of areas, for example, in the suburbs where Democrats have already seen success in what used to be strongholds for the GOP. That, of course, is leading to a change in the caucus, and Illinois, the moderates in Illinois just mirroring somewhat in Washington, we could also see greater influence from more kind of conservative hardliners that perhaps come from downstate. I'm not saying to the T, but there is a lot of that. So a kind of a changing dynamic there. Durkin also has difficulty just because it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy or a circle, however you want to term it, that you see a lot of donations going into Democrats because they already hold the power. And so it makes fundraising a harder thing. Republicans thought that they could have really capitalized when, before the last election, it was with all Democratic votes that Illinois increased its income tax rate. That said, you saw not only Democrats win, they have historic majorities. So all of those things, I think, make it very difficult for Republicans. They're going to continue to try and hammer home on Illinois' budget difficulties, the inability of Democrats to get anything done. For instance, when it comes to pensions, there's talk that maybe Republicans won't even want to go along with any sort of vote in the veto session or the forthcoming legislative session because they want to continue to make Democrats look bad.
Well, with that, I think we're going to have to end our discussion. We do have Leader Durkin on the line, so we can pose those challenging questions to him. I want to thank both of you for being on the program today, Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Radio and Tom Kasich of the News Gazette in Champaign-Urbana. I'm sure we'll have lots more to talk about pretty soon, and I hope to have you back on the show to discuss the political scene. We'll be talking in a moment with Jim Durkin, the minority leader of the Illinois House. This is Focus on WYLL. We're back on Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows. My next guest ran for the U.S. Senate against Dick Durbin a few years ago and received 38% of the vote. He's done better in the Illinois General Assembly, where he's been the state representative from Western Springs from 1995 to 2002 and from 2007 until the present. Now he's not just an Illinois House member, he's the leader of the House Republicans. Representative Jim Durkin, welcome to Focus.
Jim, thank you. Thank you for having me on. And, I tell you what, that 38% still, one of those things still sticks in the back of my mind. But it was, it's a learning lesson. Thank you for having me on.
Okay, well, thank you. And let me just make a quick call out. You can call with your questions for Leader Durkin at 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WYLL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Mr. Durkin, you've been the House Minority Leader for about, I think, 3 weeks now.
No, it doesn't become official until next Tuesday, actually.
Oh, so you're just sort of like...
I was selected by my House Republican colleagues back in the end of August. But there is a process which needs to take place on next Tuesday in which there will be a formal vote presented to the House of Representatives approving my... or ratifying the vote that was taken a few weeks back by the House Republicans. But I have to be approved. So I've got to mend some fences with some Democrats that I've given a hard time to on the floor over the past few years. But I'm cautiously optimistic that I'll be approved on Tuesday.
You're doing your organizational work during a legislative recess and midterm. I think most incoming legislative leaders would do things at the beginning of a session. What's it like getting this work done now?
Despite the fact that I'm the minority, you know, elect leader, there is a lot of work to be done. I have to put together, I've selected my own leadership team. We're about a month and a half out of from filing petitions in the elections, and also I've got to raise some money. We're a little bit behind the eight ball, so. To say that it hasn't been time consuming is a lie. It's been very time consuming, but it's a challenge that I expected, and I expected that there would be a lot of work over the first 3 or 4 months, not only dealing with just personnel matters, but we've got some, you know, we may have some issues in the veto session that I have to get my arms around as well. So, but you know, I've been down there for a few terms now. I understand the dynamics of the. Of the Capitol. I understand the dynamics of the individuals, and I'm prepared to move forward and be the voice for the House Republicans. And ultimately, the goal is I got to win seats, and we need to be more relevant in the process. But at the same time, my goal and I've stated time and time again is that I'm down there to get results for my constituents, and that's to try to pass some of the most important. Issues of legislation that affects the the businesses, the taxpayers, and the households on a daily basis. So we got our work cut out for us, but I'm ready for the challenge, though.
Well, that raises two big questions for you. First, one of them is trying to win more seats for Republicans in the House, and the other one is trying to get results for your constituents when you are a distinct minority in the House right now. Why don't we start with that first one? What sort of role can Republicans play when Democrats have a supermajority in the chamber?
Oh, well, I will tell you what, and I think that the Speaker understands that there's some very difficult issues that we have to deal with every year, and he certainly cannot rely upon whether it's 71 votes, if there's a certain matter needs a supermajority, or just a certain threshold of 60. It's very difficult for him to find consensus within his caucus. And I know that for a fact. I've seen it. He does and will rely upon Republicans on a lot of issues. He's told me that, and he's said told that to my predecessor. So, the issues, I'll take one, the biggest issue of the day, pension reform. He says that he's going to need Republican participation on this to get it passed. So we are relevant, despite the fact that our numbers are not as robust as they should be. We are relevant in this legislative process. And he does not, and a lot of the issues that we are going to be taking on are ones that he's going to have problems with some of his members, or there's just some of his members who are in vulnerable political seats that does not want to put on a vote which could be considered controversial. So that's the reality of that chamber. So I'm going to work with the Speaker. I think that there's issues that transcend politics, and namely the finances of the state. So I want to get travesty that we have the deficits that we have. We are not paying our bills, and that we have this spiraling public pension system that we have this unfunded liability that's closely reaching $100 billion.
Well, what is your caucus? What do the Illinois House Republicans want to do concerning pension reform, and what can be done if you're facing the potential of a court ruling that would put real limits on what can be done to alter current current labor contracts?
Jim, I guess the issue is that every bill and every piece of legislation we pass is subject to judicial review. This is no different than any other one, except that, you know, there's clearly a number of people have opined ahead of time of what the their constitutional thoughts on any pension bill, which would have an effect on the current benefit programs. We have seven men and women who are work across the street from the Capitol that will make that decision. Our job is to try to come up with a good, sound proposal that meets constitutional muster. And everybody's got a different opinion about what's constitutional and what isn't. But but at the end of the day, we need to pass a bill that has significant savings and one that we believe that complies with the provisions within our Constitution. But I'm glad that my colleagues, many of them for the first time, have actually cited the Constitution for a reason to not support legislation. The first time in my 14 years that people outside the legal who don't have legal backgrounds are now relying upon the Constitution. So I'm glad that they're more engaged and hope they can use that same analysis on other bills that fly through the chamber with ease, and hope that they would take a more use that as a good start for them to analyze and assess legislation that comes down through the House and Senate moving forward.
Are you content to let the committee work on a plan for pension reform and just present it to the chamber, or I guess both chambers, or do you think more work will have to be done outside?
I believe more work needs to be done. I do believe that there is some progress has been made, but there needs to be additional work done by the committee. I feel that they're making some progress, but I think that there clearly is room for improvement. Republicans are willing and have been participating, but I think that the Democrats who are running the conference committee need to realize that they need to do more than just negotiate amongst themselves. They need to negotiate with the Republicans who serve in that conference committee as well.
Okay.
And that's where we're going to getting through right now. We have recommendations that have been presented. I'm not going to get into details because we've kind of kept that in check at the moment. But there are proposals which we've asked them to consider, and we think are important for us as Republicans to for us to be able to get our arms around and support an ultimate, piece of work.
If we get something done on pension reform, does that pave the way for the legislature tackling some other financial issues for the state?
Well, I think what it does is that if we take on pension reform and we pass a bill that's meaningful, and everybody's got their own interpretation of what meaningful is, the first, it'll be measured by how the credit agencies look at the legislation. And if we can see that we get a positive outlook from Moody's, Fitch, or S&P, I think it's going to give the state some breathing room. But the next issue we have to tackle are the unpaid vouchers that we have. We have some up to $6 billion of unpaid bills to state vendors, where we... 2.5 years ago, the income tax temporary tax increase was passed to pay those vendors, and it didn't. It didn't pay any of them. It went right to the pension system. So the next issue is to bring some sanity back to our way we do business with state vendors. But, you know, we're going to get through pensions, and at some point there'll be another issue. We have to deal with our Medicaid system, which is growing by leaps and bounds. Just to give you some perspective on it, back in 2003, when George Ryan left as governor, our pension program, it was about a $6 billion expenditure, our Medicaid system was about a $6 billion proposition for our budget. It's up to $16 billion right now. So if you think about, you know, we raise about $35 billion in revenues from the state. We have two systems that, if between pensions and our Medicaid system that have swallowed up state revenues. So the next big issue, and you know, we're going to have to address is how we are able to reduce the cost of our Medicaid system and do it in a more efficient manner that eliminates fraud, waste, and the types of concerns that we hear about day in and day out. We've tried very hard to try to bring some sanity into that system, but we'll get through one, and then there'll be another issue we have to deal with. So we need to put pensions to rest. I want to get our credit rating back up. I don't know if people quite understand when we're downgraded, it just makes our ability to go out to the market and issue debt, which basically is used to pay our bills, keep the lights on, not pay our bills, but to keep state employees paid and all the other functions of state government, just becomes that more expensive, and our interest payments are become prohibitively high.
Let me ask you about the challenge of electing more Republicans to the Illinois House. How do you hope to do that in 2014?
Well, a lot of it's going to depend upon them. You know, it's going to be hard work. We're recruiting aggressively right now. We have candidates that are out passing petitions. We have to make a case, a stronger case, this next cycle of to voters, mainly independent voters, of whether or not they think that the current stewardship of the state of Illinois is benefiting them and is it making their families that much better. I will tell you this, that the economic and the job growth of Illinois is horrible. We're at 9.2% unemployment. There is a concern that is now going past just the corporate boardrooms. It's in families and their dining room tables, young families particularly, who have told me, because I live in a nice neighborhood, a lot of young families, and they're very concerned about the finances of the state, that ultimately that if we do not resolve the issues regarding our pensions and the other big issues of the day, do it in a fair way, or a responsible way, which doesn't put any further exposure upon taxpayers, if we can't do it, they're considering leaving the state, because they know that ultimately at the end of the day, that if there's going to be this all this debt that is continued to go unresolved, there will be a major tax increase that will be forthcoming, whether it's going to be through changing the tax code to a graduated tax or extending out the temporary tax, which they'll be responsible for, and ultimately their children will be responsible for. So families are talking about packing up and leaving the state as well. So our job is to do make it a more robust type of communication with independent voters about why we think that there needs to be change. We're talking since 2003. The Democrats have run the state of Illinois, and they've run it into the ground. For whatever reason, we have not been able to resonate that fact as strong as we can with hardworking men and women in the state who want the best for their children. They want the best for education. They also want economic opportunities and job opportunities for their kids.
The challenge seems to be not just saying that Democrats bad, but that Republicans are good, and that Republicans are the ones you can trust to take care of these issues.
Well, that is what we have to do, and we have to be able to give them a reason to vote for us. It's not because just Democrats are bad, but Jim, I think it's what's important is that we have to identify where the votes are. You have in a state, there's becoming a bigger block of independent voters who don't have trust in the parties. 23% of individuals who are registered to vote identify themselves as Republican, maybe 27, 28 as Democrats, but the balance are independent voters. And our job is to be able to find out exactly, is it really a pocketbook issue that is going to drive them to the polls and ultimately make their decision on who they're going to support. And I think it is. We are going to also, and I'll be perfectly honest, we need to have a strong candidate for governor. And I'm not sure who that strong candidate is right now, but I think it could. We're going to need some strong person at the top of the ticket. And if we are able to do that, I think the lower end of the ticket with the House and Senate will benefit as well. So there's going to be some luck. It's going to be a lot of hard work. I'm not going to, you know, I'm realistic when I meet with donors and I meet with other groups that want to help out, but I'm realistic about the expectations that on this next cycle. But with that being said, I think that there's opportunity in different parts of the state. Are there
particular areas where you see opportunity?
Well, Southern Illinois has increasingly become a stronger area for Republicans, and we're looking at candidates in the Metro East area and also in Central and Southern Illinois as well. There are a few seats in the collar counties that we believe that are clearly in play, ones that we lost only by a few votes the last cycle, and we kind of know the reasons why we lost those races. So those are places that we are going to pick up votes. I mean, am I going to pick up vote seats in the city of Chicago? I don't think so. Suburbs are becoming even more of a challenge for us. We will have some individuals running against incumbent Democrats in those areas, but the real races are going to be won in the collars and I would say Southern Illinois.
Okay. Well, I wanted to thank you, Jim Durkin. He is a state representative and the new, or at least will be when the fall veto session begins, and he's officially named the new GOP leader in the Illinois House. Mr. Durkin, thank you very much for joining us today.
That sounds great. Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it. Look forward to doing it again.
Okay. And thanks to our guests earlier on Focus today, Tom Kasich of the News Gazette and Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Radio. Welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. Or will likely the first result on your search engine under WILL Focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon with Scott Cameron. Jason Croft is our technical director. Sari Lesk, our intern, helping with production and research. Tomorrow on Focus, we look at different aspects of wheelchair athletics, including an interview with Tatiana McFadden. She's the U of I student who has so far won the women's wheelchair division in the Boston, London, and Chicago marathons. That's all this year. She now has her sights set on New York. That's on Thursday's show. This is Focus on WILL.